Friday's 5 o'clock. There's no news from Murdoch. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. The home of everything the government doesn't want you to know. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. Well, it's just old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. We'll also be hearing from Simon Killane, who's an independent councillor on Wiltshire County Council, with some fascinating insight into politics. How it really works, folks. And after the 6 o'clock news, Russian ambassador to Turkey has been assassinated and a lorry crashed into a Christmas market in Berlin, mounting questions about both events, which throw doubt on the competence of those who are supposed to be looking after us, who hide behind this wall of national security. Also, Egyptian police arrest a film crew faking scenes supposedly from Syria, but over in Egypt. Whilst in the real Aleppo, scores of Western intelligence officers paid with our taxpayers' money are arrested by their Syrian Arab army whilst being evacuated from Aleppo along with the terrorists. Or the rebels, or the fighters, or whatever you call them. Also tonight, the final frontier. For what? Propaganda? We take a look at the weaponization of space and how the US is hyping the threat from Russia and China up in space whilst making the running in the space race. With weapons. Was this what The Man on the Moon was really all about? A cover for Nazi boffin Wernher von Braun's post-war NASA mission? Well, whether that's true or not, the United States is beginning to dominate and to weaponise space. Is the missile defence system, the US one, being installed in Eastern Europe going to spark the next Cuban Missile Crisis? Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute. But first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 5 Celsius, breezy, but actually mostly dry. I know it's difficult to believe with the rain out there right now, but mostly dry tonight. This weekend, highs of 14 Celsius, bright and breezy and dry. Tomorrow, that's Christmas Eve. Christmas Day will be wet, mild and very windy. Next week, highs of 10 Celsius, plenty of sunny spells midweek and mainly dry. Next weekend, that's the 31st of December and the 1st of January, highs of 10 degrees Celsius. Again, wet and windy on New Year's Eve. Sunny spells, though, thank goodness, at last on New Year's Day. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com, taking us in to the new year. So helping us review this week's news is old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. But today we make the case for the destruction of party politics as we now know it, bringing you the shocking tale of a Wiltshire County councillor who left the Liberal Democrats in disgust after being successfully stood as an independent in Malmesbury. He soon realised even local politics is controlled by vested interests. So he and his family, and what happens when you hear to them, when you fail to toe the line, you'll hear what happens to them, of the rich and powerful. Martin, I mean, I know you're a member of the Labour Party, but I know you have some sympathy for those that criticise party politics.
Well, obviously I've not heard what this chap's got to say, and it'll be interesting to hear. But underlying everything is how politics is funded. It's all about the money at the end of the day.
I remember you saying a couple of times on this programme, when you don't know what it's about the money.
Yep. I mean, if you think about it, politics has to be funded by something. It's funded by somebody or some organisation or individuals, and those people extract a pound of flesh for putting their money in, for making their money available.
I mean, how has the system over the years evolved? Because it does seem as if, particularly in the Labour Party, the selection system for MPs is crucial, and it's changed a lot over the last 30, 40 years, certainly since the arrival of Tony Blair.
Well, in the past, individual Labour MPs were sponsored by individual trade unions. Those trade unions would then basically have quite a strong influence over what those MPs did or said. And that changed with Blair's accession to the leadership, because the unions used to be, so the National Union of Mine Workers, for example, used to pretty much control all the MPs from South Yorkshire. But of course the money they spent was all in South Yorkshire, and it didn't help the Labour Party win national elections. So perfectly logically, it was decided that that was going to be centralised, that the money was all be put in a central pot and spent in the most appropriate places to win national elections. But of course what that then meant was that the unions who were actually funding the Labour Party lost all control over policy, and they just became, you know, sheep to be shorn, and they carried on funding the party, but they had no influence over the policy.
So how does someone like Peter Mandelson, who anyone that looks into him will see is extremely close to the City of London, an extremely right wing in the Labour Party, how does someone like him get to be selected as an MP?
Well, you then have the process of you know, they're weeding out, the Blairites weeding out people they weren't happy with, you know, people retiring, dying, whatever, and the new people selected had to fit in with the new regime. And in many ways, lots of middle-of-the-road Labour Party members went along with this because, you know, obviously you want to win, so you've got to focus on winning the constituencies which you've got to win in order to win a general election. But of course what it meant was, eventually, is that the party leadership essentially has a blank cheque to do whatever it wants, not answerable to the rank and file, not answerable to the funders, i.e. the unions. So what Blair was very keen to do was bring in lots of business funding, which would undermine the union's position, and that, you know, it was a very fraught relationship therefore developed between the trade union leadership and the Labour leadership. And don't forget, several trade unions disaffiliated from the Labour Party, like the Fire Brigades Union, because they just felt that the party no longer represented their interests.
Yeah, I mean, you've got, for example, there was that hedge fund owner, wasn't there, or a manager, who was a member of the Labour Party, who actually launched a legal action against the party in order to try and stop Jeremy Corbyn being allowed to stand as leader.
Yeah, I mean, don't forget, the struggle to control the Labour Party is a fundamental struggle, because potentially, as a big mass party, with the history that it's got and all of the background that it's got, it's potentially capable of changing the society in a positive direction. And that's why the wealthy and powerful either oppose it outright, as many hedge fund type people do, or if they're not going to oppose it outright, they make sure that they're running it and that it's going to fit in with what they want. So what big capital wants is, you know, they don't have to do much to control the Tory party. They control that by default. I mean, Theresa May's husband is a big money man, and but the point is that the Labour Party,
can we just say a bit about, before we move on, let's just say a little bit about him, because I do wonder who's wearing the trousers between him and Theresa May. When you look at he's one of the managers of something called Capital Group in Los Angeles. Now, Capital Group are major investors in Lockheed Martin, for example, mm-hmm. Starbucks, G4S. Of course, we've had the prison riots this week and last weekend in Birmingham. So there's big questions over that. They're also a big investor in Merck, which is the pharmaceutical company behind the MMR vaccine, which is a massive controversy about that, and complete closing down of the discussion, for example, with this film Vaxxed, and attempts to rubbish Andrew Wakefield, who's a doctor who's been critical. So, you know, rather than actually allowing the debate, there's an actual massive legal attempts to close the debate down on these issues. So there are questions, there's got to be, about the relationship when the Prime Minister's husband is such a massive investor in things like the arms industry, the pharmaceutical industry, G4S, Starbucks, and the like.
And tax evasion, of course, which is mainly what they're about. The reason they're advising these things is to try and avoid paying taxes. Well, if you think back to Dennis Thatcher, Margaret Thatcher's other half, I mean, he had massive business interests in South Africa. And, of course, that had a major influence on her policy, where she refused to bring in sanctions against South Africa, even though the US was moving in that direction and so on. And probably, you know, the South African connections of her husband probably led to the prolongation of apartheid for several years.
Also got a stake, Capital Group, and Philip May has got a big stake in JP Morgan Chase. They're actually quite an important big player, aren't they, internationally?
Yeah, I mean, we shouldn't be surprised if the ruling class looks like the ruling class. That's why they rule, because they control all of these financial interests, and then those financial interests control the government. And that goes for all governments. It's more direct and hands-on with Tory governments, but with Labour governments, people like Mandelson, perfectly happy to provide the necessary oil to wheel.
Okay, so
the
Philip May is a relationship manager. One does wonder what those relationships are like, don't they, between Philip May and these big companies, and what promises he's able to make via his wife.
I think probably the direct benefit of his companies is not really, they probably don't talk about the exact business that he gets up to. The point is that the general point of view, which is in favour of big companies like that, is what his wife represents. She won't be doing, I don't suppose, individual favours for the companies he represents. She's just creating the general atmosphere in which those companies prosper, in which they are able to avoid
tax and so forth. Allowing arms sales to Saudi Arabia, which Amnesty says is one of the worst human rights abusing regimes in the world, and it's also massacring civilians and breaking all the Geneva Conventions.
Yeah, but Theresa May would argue that she's not doing that in order to benefit British companies. She's doing that because it's part
to benefit her husband.
Well, no, it's part of our general.
Because it's not a British.
It's part
company.
Of our general strategy to support Islamist extremism, as I've been doing since the 1980s. That's why we're in bed with Saudi Arabia.
This is a one-point.
They provide the linkage with the Islamic extremist movement, which allows Britain to pursue its foreign policy goals.
Well,
with the Americans.
Quite definitely steered us away from talking about the Labour Party and Labour Party funding.
It's all linked.
But Labour MP Jamie Reid has quit Parliament this week. Labour MP Jamie Reid to take a job in the nuclear industry. This ex-Shadow Health Minister said it was an honour to represent Copeland since 2005, adding to leave Parliament is the hardest decision of my life. He will stand down at the end of January, triggering a by-election in a seat Labour retained with a 2,500 majority. He's been a persistent critic of Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, it's a bit unfortunate that he's chosen to step down. It'll create another possible row inside the Labour Party.
It's more than that, isn't it? This is a continuing coup that's going on and on and on. Every week something else is going on. When is Jeremy Corbyn actually going to deal and get some discipline in the Labour Party?
Well, no, the problem is that he can't just do what he wants because it's a party with different factions within it. You're quite right. Jamie himself has suggested that he's just, you know, retiring to do another kind of working as PR for the nuclear industry, which he
But of course, this is a massive vote of no confidence in Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, isn't it? I'm not interested in being an MP anymore with this guy in charge. I'm off.
Well, no, what he's actually said is it's nothing to do with Corbyn. It's just that he feels that he can probably earn more money working as PR for the nuclear industry.
Yeah, well, that shows how little loyalty he's got to the party.
Well,
there is no discipline in the Labour
Party.
The Labour Party, Martin, is like a bunch of hippies sitting around cross-legged with Jeremy Corbyn saying, kumbaya, and let's all be nice to each other.
No.
It's no discipline.
There may very well be a plot by people like Alistair Campbell to have a continuous battle going on over Jeremy Corbyn's leadership. What they will be hoping, and Tony Blair's been absolutely explicit about this, he wants to see Jeremy Corbyn defeated, he's made it clear, that they will be hoping that Labour will lose the by-election, and then that can cause further pressure on Corbyn's leadership.
This is a very narrow Labour seat, so this is causing all sorts of trouble if he loses it. You mentioned Mandelson there, and I just discovered yesterday, actually, looking at Twitter and various other places, that it was Michael Meacher MP who died in September, must have been October, I think, last year. That he was criticising Peter Mandelson. He actually said, can Peter Mandelson actively advocate the ousting of the new leader? This is just after Jeremy Corbyn had been elected and still remained a member of the Labour Party. He was actually calling for some discipline in the Labour Party, and then he suddenly died.
Well, he did, and he was getting on a bit, so you can't necessarily read anything into that. I think the fact is that we can't stop people like Mandelson. I mean, people like Tony Blair is still a member of the Labour Party, even though he's arguably a war criminal, and he's openly called. He said he'd rather Labour lost an election than win under Corbyn. Blair's openly said that. Now, we could, I suppose, take the view that in that case he should be expelled from the party. I don't think we are going to take that view, because we're actually taking the view that you can say whatever you like, but then we're going to say what we like, that you are a waste of space.
Well, okay,
and that you may retain your Labour Party membership,
but
that's conditional.
Can I just tell you what Michael Meacher said in that article? The headline is, can Mandelson actively advocate the ousting of the new leader, as referring to Jeremy Corbyn there, and still remain a member of the Labour Party? What he says is, what's so objectionable about Mandelson's pronouncement announcements is that it betrays his view that the Labour Party isn't a democratic party at all, simply an instrument for his own clique to gain power and retain power. He sees it as his own personal or factional fiefdom, which somehow he has a God-given right to control, as though that were the natural order of things. Well, surely, if that's what Mandelson was doing, he should have been suspended. Instead, what's happened is almost every Labour Party member who's gone onto Twitter or Facebook and said that the Owen Smith coup attempt against Jeremy Corbyn, that the people involved in that were Blairites, have been suspended from the party. And yet Mandelson seems to be untouchable.
Well, that's because the infrastructure of the party, as in the full-time officials, the people who are paid to work for the party, are basically part of the previous clique. Many of them had hopes of becoming MPs, etc., and they are under the old dispensation, and they're basically sabotaging everything we do. I'm afraid we're stuck with that. My view is people can say whatever they like. They can say what they like, and we're going to say what we like. They are traitors. We're not going to expel them from the party. We're just going to use the T word. You're a traitor.
Unless you do something about it in the Labour Party, Martin, you're going to lose the next general election, aren't you?
Well, I'll tell you what will eventually happen if they carry on down that road, is that the party's going to split, but they're going to leave it. We're not leaving the Labour Party. They're leaving
it. Isn't it better to make that split happen sooner rather than later?
No. Let's drag it out.
And lose the election.
The right wing of the party are perfectly happy for Labour to lose the next election in this country. They want us to lose.
I'm actually amazed that people seem to be so, within the Labour Party, so happy for this kind of theatre to carry on, whilst serious politics is sort of thrown out the window.
Do you know what? Because we think that ordinary people can see through this nonsense, and we're not going to waste time even arguing with them. We're just going to get on with what we want to do and call a spade a spade. These people are history. They are never going to run the Labour Party again, whatever they may think. They may sabotage us enough to lose a by-election or even to lose the general election, but they're never going to control the party again, and eventually they will force themselves out. And when they're gone, we will just say good riddance, goodbye. And then we'll move on. Because don't forget, we've got a crisis of capitalism here, which is going to run and run and run.
And meanwhile, the Labour Party is paralysed. Whoopee. Anyway, let's get back to this independent councillor from Malmesbury, Simon Killane, now. I spoke to him a couple of weeks ago about his journey, really, from Lib Dems to become an independent councillor in the town of Malmesbury, and then to start to take on some of the vested interests in that area, really to look at planning and how the future of the town of Malmesbury is going to evolve over the next few years in terms of planning. He actually managed to get quite a lot of action going before he started being bullied. Well, we'll probably hear some stuff about next week about the bullying, but here's Simon Killane.
My name is Simon Killane. I'm the Wiltshire councillor from Malmesbury. I'm also the chair of scrutiny at Wiltshire Council.
So which political party are you in?
Independent.
Why?
Because I couldn't find a home in the political parties because I'm disillusioned with their dishonesty, the way they carry on, the culture of parties, the falseness. I mean, I could go on and on and on. I think the political system in the UK is smashed, not just broken. So for me, being an independent as an elected representative gives me the freedom to say and do what I feel is right.
So how do you actually manage to get elected? Surely you need a little bit of money behind you or a party system behind you to actually get yourself elected.
It's a really difficult world. I actually tried to become the MP for North Wiltshire. And unless you have tons of money and you use vicious propaganda and lies and you trash the other party, you haven't got a chance in hell.
So how did you get on in the parliamentary campaign?
I got a few hundred votes. I'm proud I got a few hundred votes because at some stage my kids are going to ask me, why didn't you do something, Dad? And I will say, I did, but nobody was listening. It's better than saying I didn't do anything.
And what about here in Malmesbury? Are you a councillor actually for Malmesbury?
I'm the Wiltshire Unitary Councillor for Malmesbury, so I've got the whole division covers the whole sort of town of Malmesbury and a bit of suburbia around it.
And so you found that it reasonably easy to beat off the Conservatives, get those sorts of votes?
It's not just Conservatives here. It's split between Liberal and Conservative. The town has a lot of what they call incomers, people who are more what they call issues voters. There's a lot of change going on as well. We see the national and international thing where people are beginning to think, I don't trust politicians and so on. So there is an opportunity as a councillor here to actually, if you can do the work and you can show that you make a difference for your community, there is an opportunity to succeed.
So under what banner do you stand? Some sort of Malmesbury First or something? What?
Well, initially, one of the things that we did in Malmesbury, and I'm thinking of another place called Froome. They did it in Froome. One of the things we did here, where we tried to transform our town council, was we had a campaign called 10-10. And basically, we went around the town plastering the number 10 and number 10 all over the place. And people wondered what it was and so on and so forth. And then we slowly released a campaign where we had 10 councillors and 10 different things we would like to do to improve our community. And those 10 council candidates were all from different kind of demographics and backgrounds and whatever, economic backgrounds. So we had mums, we had older people, we had working people. And that was an amazing campaign. I ended up getting the highest vote, along with a whole pile of other people who'd never been in a town council before. And I remember people telling me, people went in to place their votes for the town council with these little 10-10 listings, because we didn't go as a party, but we said, we 10 councillors, we have these set of principles we will abide by and these things we want to do. And so people voted for us literally as a block.
So you're saying that you think the existing system's broken. How?
Totally broken.
I mean, it's not difficult to persuade people of the idea that maybe there's nobody worth voting for, maybe they're all in it together, that kind of thing. But what specifically do you think is most broken about the system as it is?
I think the party system is a psychotic, self-destroying, almost like a virus. You know, if you're from the Yellow Party and I'm from the Pink Party, and you come up with a great idea, culturally, within a political world we're in today, I will try and sabotage or steal your idea, or I'll try and trash your idea and say it's rubbish. You know, I'm an engineer, and engineers sit down and talk to each other, and they challenge each other on ideas and brainstorm. It cannot function. And of course, what's happened is that when election time comes, all the parties, all the politicians absolutely call each other liars, thieves, everything else. The public disengage, and of course, what happens is they think to themselves, these people aren't worth voting for. What else is out there? And when you live in a world now where you're not just getting your news from dodgy newspapers, which are controlled by a small number of a centralised group of people, and most of these newspapers are full of car adverts and everything else, the reality is you're going onto social media and you're getting your information from all sorts of places. You're being radicalised. There are groups set up to say, This is how you've been lied to, but isn't like that.
Are you talking about fake news?
Fake news, but fake news has always been. Fake news has been there from the start. I mean, I was at a cabinet meeting today with the council. Really good. People talking about adult social care, children's services, talking about what they're going to do about big issues in the county. You go into the high street in Malmesbury and ask anybody, what does the council do? They won't have a clue. So fake news is out there, and it's been out there for ages. The problem now is that the establishment, I say establishment, the old-fashioned political machine of this country, the conventional parties, are not able to wake up to the fact that the media is no longer controllable, that better the devil you know process, which was this kind of centralised media with a few newspapers telling us stuff, herding us like sheep, that is coming apart, and people are finding their own information. The problem is, a lot of this information is not true. So to find the truth out there now is bloody impossible. And so until they say, we are going to start doing things in such a way that open, transparent, honest, the public are going to rubberneck. They're going to say, I don't trust these people. I'll vote for him or I'll vote for her. And they'll probably vote for something else worse. And so, you know, today again at Wiltshire Council, there was a discussion about streaming cabinet meetings. We've had cameras around the room for God knows how long. I put my hand up and said, I'd like to see the streaming of scrutiny meetings. And in January, we're going to start doing that. And then that starts to give a realism. You know, you ask a question about what your council is doing on, say, the local bus or what, you know, what your mum's care package in a local home. You can go on there and see the interaction between the cabinet member and people who ask the questions and so on. But we haven't got there yet. So we have a broken political system. We have a media that is rapidly going through a massive revolution of change. And we have a black hole at the moment. That black hole, it could swallow us up. We could end up with a cycle of worse politicians than we had before, nobody believing a word they hear, and we finding ourselves in a position where we're saying we really could do with the truth and not being able to get it. And I think it's incumbent on the political system to change, and I don't think it can. And sometimes I think, horrible to say it, you almost need a revolution. You need a huge economic downturn. You need some big, massive climatic event before the system is shaken apart and people say, right, we got to do something here. I think Donald Trump has been a wake-up call. I think the Brexit thing has been a wake-up call, that basically there's a huge shift in opinion that is not controlled by this decentralised establishment, that people can actually go out there en masse and vote for something completely different to what the pollsters and what the political parties are taught was the status quo. And I think that must be quite frightening for them. But again, the problem is, by changing that system, by changing the political system we have today, by making it open, transparent, honest, fair, because it isn't, you end up killing yourself off. You are part of a system. You got into it because of favour, because you were able to manipulate people, because you were able to tell lots of fake stories. Now, by making it honest, you'll be out of it. And the money and power and influence you have will be spread out into different people.
Okay, so who is really making the decisions if elected representatives, city councillors and MPs aren't then?
I believe it's very simple, and it's been like this for thousands of years. It's people with money and power, either power that they've managed to gain through generations, we'll call all money, or money they've managed to make through big financial interests, property, land, minerals. They tend to be the people who drive the decision making behind the scenes. So they're not there at the front line, and they don't want to be. They don't want to be the politicians. They're driving the money chain, and we all know this. Go on just to any reputable site on the internet and look at the donations to all the parties. Whether it's the Labour Party, the Conservative Party, Liberal Party, they're the people who put the money into those parties and the people that make the decisions. You know, I'm certain that, you know, I've been a politician for 8 years and I've done everything by the book, and I've tried to make sure I've had a website telling people what I want to do and my policies, and I've been open, transparent. I'm certain if I won the lottery tomorrow morning and I would have had a ticket into the system, I would have just talked to one person and he would have said, don't worry, you'd make a perfect candidate for such and such a division or such and such a constituency, as long as I was willing to part with some of my cash. It's about money. And it's always been power, resources, whatever it might be. If it's coal in one country, oil in another. Here, where I live, it's land. It's about land. Land
is. It is, isn't it? And you've got, for example, still, I think it's the Duke of Beaufort with something like 50,000 acres. Now, hang on, that's Gloucestershire. But I mean, in Wiltshire, who are the big players around here?
Well, big players around here are Lord Suffolk. So I don't know how hundreds of thousands of acres he has, but he's one of those stereotypical landowners who had, and through generations, sort of swathes of land here. You've got other smaller farmers who own hundreds of acres of land, but it tends to be around the market towns, on the edges of market towns, it tends to be big landowners who own very, very prominent, important pieces of land that are important to the development and expansion of a town. So, in effect, their estates sort of abut the market towns. And you have the farmers abutting the market towns, and they tend to be the places where the land is most valuable. Because,
well, of course, it's going to be development on that land, isn't there? That's the thing. And if you give us an idea of someone who's been involved in the planning system a lot, the sort of increase in value that a field that was an agricultural field will have if it's given planning permission for housing.
I made a very interesting sort of commentary once where I said communities look out onto a field and they see beauty, they see grass, they see trees, they see animals, they see community, they see heritage, all that kind of stuff, nature, you know. And that's about 15 grand's worth. An acre of land, probably 15 grand's worth. Somebody with a keen eye for money and property and development and all that stuff will look onto an half an acre land. All they'll see is money. All they'll see is pound notes, £5 notes, £50 notes, and up to £1 million in some cases. So, the land value is astonishing. It's more valuable than gold in some
cases. So when you pass a planning application for a field to become housing, what kind of increase are we talking about?
Well, I don't know what mathematically it is, but it's a massive increase in value from thousands to potentially over £1 million for an acre, hectare, whatever it might be of land. You can't be specific because it depends where the land is. If the land is 2 miles outside your town and outside the sort of strategic, what they call a core strategy area for development, and there's limitations on what can be built, you can build two or three houses. If it's close to a town and there's a big demand for expansion, developers need to build houses because the strategy of the council says so many houses must be built within a period, or there's economic development going on and so on and so forth, population movement, people coming from London and living in rural areas, then the land can be worth astonishing amounts of money.
So whatever happened to the green belt then?
the Green Belt was a nice idea. Everybody talks about the Green Belt and they talk about, you know, brownfield versus greenfield, but they're mythical, really, because they don't really exist anymore in policy. And actually, you've got to be very careful as well about adopting very one-dimensional views in these things. You know, we had a situation here where we had what was alleged to be a greenfield site next to our town, and we had a small planning application to build a Waitrose supermarket on it. When all the studies were done to look at the effect of that supermarket on the town, I was involved in asserting that we needed to commission independent studies, the people and the experts said, yeah, this will be okay for your town. It'll actually help it quite a bit. There isn't that much supermarket, whatever you call it, capacity. The policies say you have to have more. If they build a nice supermarket and it's disguised and it's got Cotswold stone glass, it'll be fine. We had lots of debate about that is the wrong place for a supermarket. It's in the green area, the conservation area, to ruin the look of the town. On the other side, we had an application for a huge Sainsbury's superstore out on what was allegedly an old the site of a garden centre. Again, the argument was, well, this is outside the sort of conservation area and it's away from the town and people can sort of live in the town, look at all the lovely views of Cotswold stone houses in the countryside, and you won't see this horrible big supermarket. But when we had the analysis done, almost every single expert said it's a town killer. It'll kill your market town. Why? Because you'll have two towns. You'll have a big supermarket a mile and a half outside your town. It will have all of the things that people need to get. They'll be able to bypass your town, and your town will lose 30% of its trade. So in that great example, people have to think a bit differently about these things.
So this is one way you manage to get people around here thinking as a as a councillor about planning. Now, there's been some changes to the way planning's done. How did you actually get people to engage with that? Because, you know, this is one of the things I think the planning system is boring. Most people don't want to engage with it and don't think they can have much of a say over the way their town develops. The people who do that are the people you were talking about, the rich, the powerful, the big landowners, those kinds of people. So how did you actually get stuck in there?
The planning system is absolutely not boring. It's projected as boring, but the planning system is fascinating and interesting. And I'll tell you, if you go onto the web and you type in Malmesbury Neighbourhood Plan, Princess Foundation workshops, and you watch where I'm with a little sort of camera running around the room and what was happening, you'll say, wow, that's incredible. It's so exciting. Because we had a process where basically by a bit of luck and because of the economic crash, the government at the time wanted to sort of incentivise communities to have more of a say in planning because they were worried about the logjam and the stopping of development because of what they call NIMBYism. And in reality as well, there was a big issue, if you remember, with development, the houses not being built because of the economic crash. And so they decided to open the door a little bit and let people, ordinary people, in to basically have more of a say in the things that matter. And the things that matter are what happens to your school, whether you have enough education places, where you can park, how much land you have for play and recreation, your high street, you know, shops, housing, you know, how many people come to live in your town, what effect will it have, will your children have a house to live in? They are things that really matter to the people. And so we got this brilliant opportunity with this neighbourhood planning process. It was a kind of a trial. We were lucky enough to get on a trial scheme. The government didn't quite know how it was going to work out. So they gave us a lot of extras that other communities didn't get. And we got this opportunity to have Prince Charles's Foundation, which was the Foundation for the Built Environment, and Planning Aid and other organisations, send experts down to our town. And for a week-long workshop process in Malmesbury, we brought the local children from the school, secondary school, we brought shop owners, we brought people from the local civic society, resident association, town councillors, Wiltshire councillors, officers, factory owners, all sorts of people, into a room, gave them nice food and tea and coffee, and then we let them basically redesign the town with these experts standing behind them, giving them advice and information and asking them questions and so on. And by the end of that week, we'd come up with basically the bones of a plan, which designated where development would occur, but also really good reasons why we wanted to develop where we wanted to develop. So we start off saying we have to have housing development, population growth and so on, government requirements, but actually these are the best places to put your business, retail, housing and so on.
Now, in other parts of the country, I'd imagine that those sorts of decisions about where those houses were going to go were made in kind of smoky rooms without a lot of involvement by ordinary members of the public.
Well, this all started because of the fact that when I became a councillor, there was a huge amount of concern about two major things in the town. This was before Neighbour Plan started, and it was about school places. So not enough school places. So what they call the infrastructure, the things you need to go along with housing, not in step with the housing. And you know, you got the houses built, but actually my child can't go to the local school, or there's congestion with traffic in the town because there's not enough parking spaces, things like that. Or there's not enough room in the primary care centre, you know, for medical and so on. So there was all that kind of tension. And then there was also tension that people were saying, the decision making is being made and we have no idea what's going on. We're not being told. It's greedy people. You need sort of mythical developers coming in, stealing from our town, building on the land and taking the money with no real concern or interest in community. And I challenged at the time the town council to have an open and transparent forum, because I discovered that there was a plan for 800 houses along the edge of our town. And I discovered it because the developer sent me a lovely brochure showing great details on how this development was going to occur, the school and all the infrastructure with it, even people walking down the streets and so on. And nobody in the town knew about it. It was like designing a town with no involvement from the people in the town. I could have just said, oh, I'll meet with the developer, and we'll have a chat and make a few changes and modifications. It's okay, on the planning committee, I'll vote for it, or I'll support it or whatever. I won't make trouble in the town. But I didn't. I said, actually, this is the wrong way to do this. There was then a suggestion in the town council that there'd be some sort of secret meeting with the developer in a hotel. And that's when I really lost kind of the plot and said, no. This is not happening. If we're going to have development in our town, as the new councillor of this town, we're going to do it in an open and transparent way. If we're going to meet with developers, there will be a proper open forum. People can come. They can find out what's going on. There was then a great denial from some people, some of the establishment figures in the town, previous politicians and so on, to say, it's all untrue. There's no 800 houses. Nothing's being done that's underhanded. And I remember going to a meeting where we literally had hundreds of people at the meeting. This is meetings where generally you wouldn't get 20 people come to a town council meeting. There's hundreds. No room. And denials from people in the room. Denials from councillors to say it's not true. And me handing the brochure around to the people in the audience and shaking my head. And then, this is it. Here's the brochure. I didn't create it. Here it is. And so that caused a lot of friction. And then the Neighbour Planning process came along, and that was really my opportunity to say, brilliant, now we have a kind of a government top-down forum that might give us a bottom-up influence in planning. And so I really pushed the agenda, managed to get us on this trial as what they called front runners. And then we started working through building our neighbourhood plan until we basically got to a referendum.
A referendum which they won, and that was Simon Killane there from Malmesbury. He's an independent councillor on Wiltshire County Council, and really has done an incredible amount, Martin Summers, in shaping the future of that town, because basically the big local landowners have already decided where they want to be the developments, which of course is on their land close to the town. But what he's done is he's brought people from right across the town together to decide what's best for the town, and that's ruffled a few feathers.
Well, indeed. And, you know, it's very instructive what he was saying there. But as he pointed out himself, 'twas ever thus. The big, powerful people tend to be big and powerful.
Also, he mentioned there this sort of whole election of Donald Trump and Brexit being a wake-up call, in a way kind of echoing what Prince Charles has been saying on Thought for the Day. Prince Charles gets his chance to sort of be a kind of religious leader and do the Thought for the Day. He's warned that risking populism has deeply disturbing echoes of the dark days of the 1930s. This whole idea of populism, I mean, Donald Trump, populist, Brexit maybe populist. Well, this is actually the majority view. So is he sort of pushing back against the whole idea of the people deciding?
Well, a bit he is, certainly, I think, but, you know, that's what the suggestion is. Don't forget that people like Aaron Banks behind Brexit and Donald Trump are multimillionaires, billionaires. They're not popular, they're a different version of wealthy.
Hang on. Let's just get back to the decisions themselves being made by the people rather than by a sort of privileged elite.
Decisions have never been made by the people.
We were talking about Mandelson earlier on, you know, someone who's very close to the City of London being very influential for many years in the Labour Party, mm-hmm. for example, and yet not really from any kind of real Labour tradition.
Well, he came from a Labour tradition in the sense that his grandfather, Herbert Morrison, was a Labour minister. He comes from a Labour aristocracy family in that sense. He went to St Catherine's College, as I did. He was a scholar.
But anyway, Prince Charles raised the plight of refugees and said their suffering did not end when they arrived in new countries. He said, "We're seeing the rise of many populist groups across the world. They're increasingly aggressive towards those that adhere to a minority faith." Well, I mean, I don't think actually Islam is a minority faith. It's one of the couple of largest faiths in the world. All of this, he says, is a deeply disturbing echoes of the dark days of the 1930s. Is that how you see it?
To some extent, yes. I don't see votes for Brexit or for Donald Trump as expressing the popular will in any general sense of the term. There were two largely fluke results. Don't forget, Donald Trump didn't even win a majority of the votes in the United States. That's pretty clear. He won the Electoral College. And, of course, he's allowed to take the presidency on that basis. And Brexit squeaked home. And in actual fact, a majority of the population didn't vote for Brexit.
What I'm saying here, I suppose, is that you've got people like Prince Charles, who are part of the establishment, who don't like it when the people don't vote the way they want.
Well, what we're finding is a polarisation going on. As in Northern Ireland, where if you are a Protestant, you are very, very unlikely to vote for Sinn Féin. And if you are a Catholic, you are never, ever going to vote for the Democratic Unionist Party. So it'll just be normal politics all over the world. A right wing and a left wing and an absolute division between them. No centre ground. Yeah? No centre ground because the centre's collapsed. Because we've got super wealthy oligarchs like Donald Trump and George Soros determining things, even though Soros and Trump hate each other, because they're the ones with the money. And everybody else just lines up behind one or the other of the oligarchs, unless you've got an independent political force.
Surely what was happening in the 1930s was an overmighty elite started to dominate in fascist, particularly in Italy and in Germany, and there were dictatorships. What's happening, surely, with this so-called populism that Prince Charles dislikes so much is completely the opposite. It's actually ordinary people that are voting for this.
Rubbish. What happened in the 1930s was that because there was a threat of change in the system coming from the left, particularly the Communist Party in Germany, the wealthy classes decided to align with the street thugs of the National Socialist German Workers' Party to crush the communists, and that's what happened. And I think we've got very similar things going on all over the world now, where people like Aaron Banks, who is basically a multimillionaire fixer behind the scenes, he's bankrolled at UKIP. He's not some populist person. He's a multimillionaire tax avoider, just like the people on the other side.
There's a lot of people voted for it, though.
They may have voted, but lots
of people... Well, they did.
No, well, they did, but a lot of people didn't vote for it as well. It was a one-off. And, of course, I'm not saying those people aren't entitled to a view. George Galloway voted for Brexit.
I mean, it seems pretty obvious to me that Charles is totally against the idea of people deciding things for themselves, because he thinks an elite should tell them what to do.
He is speaking out as, you know, in some ways he's entitled to do as head of the Church of England, head of state to be.
Well, he's not, yeah, well, maybe.
Well, yes, all of those things he's to be.
I don't know if he is.
And he's saying there is a danger of intolerance. I think there is. Nigel Farage had a go at Joe Cox's husband, Brendan Cox, this week, saying he'd politicised her murder. Now, let's get this clear. Thomas Mayer was absolutely clear why he killed her. He said he was for Britain first, and that's why he shot her. Now, Nigel Farage says that Brendan Cox is making politics out of that. I think Thomas Mayer's the one who made the politics out of it, and Farage seems to be supporting him.
This is interesting.
To Farage,
anyway,
he can say what he likes, and we'll say we think you're supporting
him. Martin, the wider point here, of course, is Prince Charles and the monarchy, should they be weighing in on these political issues?
Well, should we have a monarchy at all? I think
We have got a monarchy. Let's not pretend we haven't. We have got a monarchy. Should Prince Charles be weighing in on these political issues?
I would argue no, but he would argue the opposite, because it's not settled. But you'll understand, 3,000 people died in the struggle in Ireland because they didn't want a monarchy, because they didn't want to be part of Britain at all, actually. So, you know, I think that people going on about populism and Trump and Brexit and all the rest of them, that's what the people want. That's what some people want, and some people are absolutely opposed to it. All the people in Ireland, for example, who voted for a majority on both sides of the border to stay inside the European Union. What about their rights?
He's talking about migrants, refugees, and that sort of thing. And obviously, there are big differences between the two. And also, there's a lot of economic refugees. But he says the rise of many populist groups across the world are increasingly aggressive to those who adhere to this minority faith. This put him in mind, apparently, of the darker days. I mean, let's just get back to this. Is it really the 1930s happening all over again? And in which...
Yes, I would argue that it is.
Where is it going?
Well, don't forget, 9/11 was an inside job carried out by the security forces of the West. And that set off an avalanche of wars all over the planet. A majority, we had a huge demonstration against the war in Iraq, but there was probably a majority of the comfortable classes who were in favour of war with Iraq. Now we've got an avalanche of refugees, and everybody wants to pull up the drawbridge. Well, I'd say all of those people in Malmesbury, and there must be many of them, who supported Blair's invasion of Iraq, maybe it's about time for you to put your checkbooks out and pay the price for the decision that you took.
So are the people that voted for Brexit and for Trump fascist numbskulls?
No, they're just wrong in my view, and they're going to get what they want, but they ain't going to like it. Britain, a hard Brexit
for
Britain.
That was going to happen anyway, wasn't it? As we all know, there's going to be a financial crash, well,
exactly.
Crisis of some sort.
So what we've actually done is wasted a lot of time talking about Brexit, which is irrelevant. In one way, it's largely irrelevant. And we've also had a load of fuss in the United States about which oligarch is going to run the policy of war with China and Russia. And they're having a squabble amongst themselves about who they're going to fight first, China or Russia. But there's definitely going to be a war. Is this like the 1930s?
Yes, it is. This idea of the invocating this idea of the 1930s in parallel to this, you've got claiming Israel is a racist endeavour. Britain is adopting a new definition of anti-Semitism. The move is seen by many, according to Haaretz, as specifically highlighting anti-Zionist and anti-Semitism. But the government could also be using it as a political tool against the left. What do you make of this? This is a new definition of anti-Semitism, where if you're criticising Israel as a racist state, then you could be, well, you will be, apparently, considered anti-Semitic.
Well, I just don't accept that. They can pass laws saying that, but it doesn't mean that I'm going to accept that. Because the state of Israel was only recognised in 1948 on the understanding that it would be within certain borders, and also on the understanding that people who've been driven from their homes would be allowed to return. That's the only basis on which we recognised Republika Srpska in the 1990s. Now, the Israelis are a country the size of Wales, with a population the size of Wales. Why should they be able to flout the international laws that everybody else is expected to obey? And we could end up with a situation where it's perfectly logical for us to say you're not entitled to a seat at the United Nations. You're not playing ball.
What about Orthodox Jews that criticise the state of Israel? Whereabouts do they fall into that definition?
Well, that's a very good question. They're obviously self-hating Jews, and therefore they're anti-Semitic, because that's the logic of that kind of argument, isn't it? What they're trying to do is criminalise political opinions, and that's never worked. It doesn't work when you try and criminalise Mandelson's silly opinions we were talking about earlier. I don't agree with him, but you can't criminalise those opinions. And the same goes with people who don't accept the state of Israel. For example, Hamas, who won the election in Palestine the last time there was a free vote over there, they don't recognise the state of Israel. And therefore they're anti-Semitic because they don't recognise. Well, why would they recognise it? When is this Israeli state going to recognise a Palestinian state? That's the Hamas position. You recognise us and we'll recognise you. We're under no obligation to recognise your state. Why should we be?
Also, whilst thinking of Israel, Jerusalem, etc., it's just Christmas weekend. A belief in God plunges after apparently a torrid year. That's in The Week. That's how they put it anyway. Atheism is surging as the Brits stop saving a prayer for a higher power. Forget believing in Santa. The tumultuous events in 2016 appear to have left Britons unable to believe in God. Well, that's a bit of an exaggeration, but the YouGov poll for The Times has shown a 4-point decline in the percentage of people who believe in a higher power, from 32% in February last year to 28% now. The drop suggests a sharper decrease than in previous years. The Times says Britain's belief in God has long been in decline at a rate of about 1% a year. Newspaper reports citing a different question used by the British Attitudes Survey in 1991, which found half the population thought there was a God.
Well, as these social changes occur, They take a long time. They don't happen quickly. It's what Matthew Arnold called the gradual roar of the sea withdrawing from the beach as people just gradually no longer believe. But that doesn't mean that they can't be changed. Other people are becoming more religious.
I mean, this is partly to do with the way that in a lot of schools nowadays, evolution is taught as fact, isn't it? It's not like something between creation and evolution are not taught as two alternatives.
I think that to blame evolution teaching in schools for these people deciding there's no God is absurd. People decide there's no God because their life experiences lead them to believe that because they've been taught about evolution.
I mean, one of the main reasons, apparently, is because people think that if God should intervene and make things better and things aren't getting better, so that's a reason why God can't be there.
Well, there's a fundamental problem, as a philosopher, they point out, the problem of evil. If God's so good, why does he allow all this evil in the world? And if it isn't him doing it, then he's not omnipotent, is he? So there's a fairly straightforward logical problem at the heart of all religious belief.
Well, what about the idea that God would just wish that people could have free will and get on with things and then maybe intervene when things go really badly wrong? But, I mean, surely a loving God is going to allow people to get it wrong, just as a loving parent sometimes wants its children to make mistakes.
Well, I think you're clutching at straws there from a logical point of view. He's either omnipotent or he isn't.
Okay, all right, Martin. So this poll says that 32% of us apparently believe in God. One of the things I thought I'd do is, because you're always going on about this financial crash, we're always having a go at the bankers, bashing the banksters, is to go to have a listen to a chap called Bill Still. He had quite a close look at Jesus and his ministry. And the only occasion where he used violence, Jesus actually used violence, that, Martin, was what?
The money changers driven from the temple, according to the story.
What would you like to, is there anything you'd like to say about that particular incident? In some ways, more interesting than almost anything else that Jesus did, that one particular act.
Well, it is, but it's a story, and therefore it's a very influential story. And still has valency and still affects us today because of its influence.
Well, millions of people believe it, whether they're right or wrong. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Bill Still talking about the sort of nuts and bolts of what happened.
In the Bible, 2,000 years ago, Jesus drove the money changers from the temple.
It was the only time Jesus used force during his ministry. What were money changers doing in the temple? When Jews came to Jerusalem to pay their temple tax, they could only pay it with a special coin, the half shekel of the sanctuary. This was a half ounce of pure silver about this size. It was the only coin around at that time which was pure silver and of assured weight without the image of a pagan emperor. Therefore, to Jews, the half shekel was the only coin acceptable to God. But these coins were not plentiful. The money changers had cornered the market on them. Then they raised the price, just like any other commodity, to whatever the market would bear. In other words, money changers were making exorbitant profits because they held a virtual monopoly on money. The Jews had to pay whatever they demanded. To Jesus, this totally violated the sanctity of God's house.
So he kind of lost it with them. Martin, this is an important sort of item in a way, in that when you are a banker, when you're in control, for example, of things like the cash point system or whatever, the chip and pin system, you do have an immense amount of power. What these money changers were doing was effectively creating a kind of scarcity in a product on which they had a monopoly.
Well, there's lots of material about this out there for people to look at. Effectively, the creation of money has been engrossed by the private sector. In theory, if you think back to the Thatcher
era, Bank of England is not a private sector.
No, it's not, but it doesn't create the money supply. The money supply is largely created by the private banking system. The fact is that the government doesn't control the money supply except indirectly through things like interest rates. But once you reach zero or very small interest rates like we've got now,
doesn't control interest rates. The Bank of England does.
Well, the Bank of England is supposedly part of the government, even though it's independent. It used to be directly part of the government until it was made independent by
Gordon Brown.
But of course it was only nationalised in 1946. Previous to that, it had been a private exercise, just like the Federal Reserve still is in the United States.
But I mean, what I suppose I'm saying isn't what's going on now out there exactly what was going on in the temple in Jesus' day, with the bankers actually restricting access to money and making sure that for a large swathes of the population that there just isn't the money for them to spend, and they're actually, I don't know, whatever it is, liquidity, is it, that they're bringing down? They're doing something similar, aren't they?
Well, yeah, but what you've got is that money is going into asset price inflation, so quantitative easing means that the banks can get a hold of their basic core material for making money from the government, but most of the money supply is created by bank checking accounts created by the private banking sector. And yes, it's fundamental to what's gone wrong. And Ellen Brown and others have been talked about pretty convincingly, to my mind, about the whole idea of making banking a public utility, which is what obviously we should have done in 2008, but we didn't do it. And we're now years down the line, and the private banking system is completely out of control, because having been bailed out, they've actually become even more powerful than they were before the crash. So we're now staring down the barrel of a gun, frankly.
Okay, also getting back down to earth a little bit more. More than 120,000 homeless children are spending Christmas in temporary accommodation, figures reveal this week. The number of homeless children who will spend Christmas in temporary accommodation, 124,000, Martin. Many will be in hostels, bed and breakfast, located miles from their original homes. Families, with the figure rising by more than 10% in a year. The Department for Communities and Local Government said 21,400 homeless households, and accounting for 29% of all those in temporary accommodation, have been moved away to different council areas. So they're not even, people are not even, are also being told, not only are you going to have to live in temporary accommodation, but you're going to have to leave where all your friends are,
and also where you go to school. So these kids, the schooling of these kids is going to be massively disrupted. That's where we're at.
On a positive note, thousands of Muslims have donated 10 tonnes of food to help the homeless Londoners at Christmas. This was in the Independent. Muslim Londoners donated 10 tonnes of food. Thousands of people attended a food drive in East London Mosque in order to make and collect donations. Around about 7,500 people attended, reported by the London Evening Standard. After they attended Friday prayers, volunteers gathered the supplies, which included rice, pasta, cereal, tinned goods and other items. Donations came from local businesses, colleges, schools and universities. They would be given to local people in need, including those who are living on the streets.
Well, I mean, that's obviously extremely positive, but really we ought to be getting rid of homelessness rather than just alleviating it. Charity is all very well, but we need to actually change the setup.
Now, there are some positive changes along those lines happening, it seems, maybe, if the government continues to support them. And we'll hear about those next year. Italy has approved the bailout for Monte del Paschi Bank. This is Italy's cabinet approved a state bailout for the country's third largest bank. 20 billion euros, that's $21 billion or £17.9 billion. Well, it seems there's plenty of money for the banks, even if they are either crooked or completely incompetent.
Yeah, and it's not quite clear how they've managed to wangle this, because it's supposedly against EU regulations. This was one of the things that they were worried about, Renzi losing the referendum over. But it could well be that that what they're scared of is that Monte dei Paschi here will be like Credit Anstalt's collapse in 1933, which precipitated the real onset of the deflationary depression. And that's, it could be. I mean, something is going to give sooner or later, sooner rather than later, I would suggest. This might be it.
For this particular bank, what do you mean? I mean,
well, the danger is that it undermines the euro, and there's a run on the euro. Then they have to ramp up QE to protect the euro. Then banking defaults could spread through the system. If this bank goes down, then don't forget they owe a lot of money to other banks. RBS is still basically bankrupt. And so it will, you know, by the long chain.
Where is this going to end? I mean, surely at some point someone's going to have to say, well, we can't bail you out. Or they're just going to continue to throw tens of billions of pounds at banks whilst people are homeless, don't have any work, etc. The money is being taken away from ordinary people and given to these failed banks.
Yeah, I think what will happen is that, as we've seen in Japan, is that they'll basically pull out any stop to keep the banking system afloat. So they'll just switch on the money press, keep chucking money at it in the hopes that the banking system can somehow be kept afloat, which will lead potentially to hyperinflation, but I don't think it will lead to hyperinflation because of the deflationary pressures at work. Eventually, and we've seen this, each injection of QE has less effect than the previous injection. So even if they decide, as in Japan, to go for any amount of money, we're not even going to tell you how many, just any amount that we can think up, eventually investors will take fright and everything will crash. But at the minute, with the stock market bubbling, you'd be a fool to leave the market. And of course, therefore, you know, they carry on bubbling until they pop.
Time for the Murdoch News at 6 now. Thanks to Martin Summers there. After the Murdoch News, the Russian ambassador Turkey assassinated and a lorry crashed into the Christmas market in Berlin. We'll be discussing that.